Hip Hop Caucus at the University of Maryland, and we're all about defying race, defying age, defying culture, and uniting for the cause of spending our money instead of on war in the cities and on education and creating a community that encourages each other and empowers each other. We are all people who believe that we want to be united and we want to be together and we want to work together to accomplish that goal.
We are united, and it's not about color, it's not about race, it's about hip hop bringing the end to this war.
I'm holding a sign from the committee United for Lieutenant Watada. As you know, Lieutenant Watada is the first commissioned officer to publicly refuse deployment to Iraq on the basis of the fact that Iraq is an illegal war and an unjust war, and the Bush administration had violated international and domestic laws when they attacked Iraq. And as a soldier, he felt that his obligation is to the Constitution and its protector, the people. And because of the fact that he's spoken out against the war and the president, he's facing two main charges. The total is 6 years maximum.
We don't think he should spend a minute in jail. He had the courage to carry out what Congress has failed to have any courage in carrying out, which is to take responsibility himself for stopping the war and for doing what he can from his position and saying, I'm not leading my troops into battle. You fight with the ones who put themselves on the line. That's who you stand with. And that's what's important for Congress people to stand with him, because he is the one right now on the line for all of us.
All feel that the war is wrong, so we came to fight against not only Bush but the whole government, the whole system, and we need to get rid of it because it's bad for the country.
They make profit over the war and stuff, and they don't really think about anybody else.
How would you spend the money if not on the Iraq war? What would you put it towards?
On schools, like help schools, help build the communities.
In my school, we don't even have a music class.
What school is that?
Secondary school for law. We don't even have a music class where we can take home our instruments. We have to share with everybody. 9th to 11th grade doesn't even have a music class. There's a lot of things that need to be solved, more than just schools. Like levees in New Orleans, that's very important. I don't even think they're going to turn it into anything for people to live. I think that's where the money's at.
It seems like if they're willing to try and rebuild Baghdad, they could rebuild New Orleans and the Gulf Coast. We could use your help over here. Why don't you bring the troops home and help us rebuild instead of rebuilding Baghdad and Iraq?
You brought a t-shirt here from home that kind of sums it up. Could you tell us what that says?
Make levies, not war. Make levies, not war. We need some levies, and we need the money that's going to the war. Some of it coming to the Gulf Coast and New Orleans to rebuild.
I was really appealing to African Americans to come out to this march, because we have not been seen as prevalently in these marches as other folks have been. We have to show our faces. It's not enough for us to say that we are not in support of the war, which a resounding majority of us were not in support of the war. We have to show that we mean business, and he has to see our faces.
DC-37 is a municipal employees union. We have 125,000 members and 50,000 retirees. We make New York City run. We got plenty of political power because we're part of AFSCME, which has a great lobbying group. And we're here to tell the Congress people our voices will be heard. Do not fund the war and bring our troops back home.
Bring the troops home and bring them home alive.
Bring them home. Bring them home. That's all.
President Bush needs to step down. He has to go.
I'm a Vietnam era veteran. During that period, I organized a GI coffee house at Fort Knox. This is a continuation of that, because I don't think any of these wars are any good. The more people we get out here, the more that the government may sit up and take notice, and I'm glad to see that there are hundreds and hundreds of veterans here today as well.
Now that the Democrats are in power, there's no excuse. We need for the Democrats to do the job we elected them to do. They've got to get us out of Iraq ASAP and investigate Bush and Cheney.
The Democrats really need to step up. They were an embarrassment to us over the last couple of years when they voted for this war. We're looking for them now to speak with numbers and budgets rather than rhetoric.
I'm optimistic that if we keep building this movement, we can stop the maniacs in the White House around this war and around their planned expansion in terms of invading Iran. We have to make it clear things cannot continue.
One of the reasons I think the march is very important is because the government isn't representing the views of the people, and that's what our country is about. The government should protect and should be a mirror of the people, and it's not in this case.
What is going to come out of it today is we are breaking boundaries and building bridges.
That's right.
And don't look down on no one unless you're trying to pick them up.
Whoa.
I quote, don't look down on anyone unless you're trying to help them up.
That's it for Sprouts. Our contributors this week included Emily Howard from New College of California in San Francisco and David Ochuto from WBAI in New York City. Sprouts is distributed and coordinated by Pacifica Radio Network, thanks to Michael Yoshida at Satellite Operations. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to rebroadcast on Sprouts to showcase it nationally, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. That's U-R-S-U-L-A @pacifica.org. I'm Doug George from WBAI in New York City. See you next week on Sprouts.
And rolling forward, it's Bathroom Spears Broadsides coming at you now on Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org here in Santa Cruz. We're about 7 minutes late. Because Sprouts ran over or somebody didn't put it on in time. Oh, ho, ho, ho. Anyway, that's fine. We got about an hour and 50 minutes to babble away at you and for you to babble at me and the rest of the community or just talk what's on your mind around issues of civil rights or lack thereof in the Santa Cruz community and around issues of homelessness, poverty, and even war and peace because that's directly linked to homelessness and poverty and civil rights issues here these days. That's my main topic. My name is Robert Norris, and this is Bathrop Spear's Broadsides. I'm Bathrop Spear. My broadsides are here, and we can fling a few out at you. Maybe you can fling a few in here and out to the rest of us who are out there, but we can't all be facing each other, but at least we can speak with each other through the medium of radio. If you want to call in, the phone number is 427-3772, 427-FRSC. And you can also reach me off air if you want to leave a message for me or if you've got some other information you want to pass on about this particular program at 427-4523, 427-4523. Finally, if you want, you can go to the Huff website, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, the group I work with. That's www.huffsantacruz, H-U-F-F, Santa Cruz, all one word, all small letters, .com. So, welcome to Bathrop Spears Broadsides. I'm alone in the studio today, but I've got a lot of information with me, and I'm going to be rolling forward with it. Maybe folks out there will also have some information. Maybe you'll have some information to add to this situation here, to if people we can all share it together. First, I want to announce it looks like we're going to be having a debate coming up in about a week and a half. This show airs on Sunday as well, a longer version of it, in the morning from 9:30 to 1 in the afternoon every Sunday. And Mike Rodkin, council member and former mayor Mike Rodkin, has agreed to be on the air to debate attorney David Myberg. And the issue here will have to do with the proposed law before the Santa Cruz City Council, which got a first reading 2 days ago and was passed unanimously by the council, which essentially sets up a scheme that empowers the Parks and Rec Department and Parks and Rec Czarina Dennett Shoemaker to set up fees and licensing schedules for any kinds of commercial activities in the parks, which sounds kind of, well, in a way, innocuous. And David Myberg actually will be probably coming in this Sunday to do a little kind of preliminary skirmishing and orienting folks out there, since Rodkin controls the council on this issue. And David is simply the attorney who actually prompted this issue to come to the council because he won a case against the city involving access to the beaches. So it apparently has to do with surf schools. The city, the Parks and Rec Department, wanted to stop a particular surf school from walking over its property, walking over public property, and then doing surfing activity in the beach without paying them a fee. And David, they issued some citations to the either the surfing school or the surfers that did this. And David Myberg went to court and got these thrown out and got the law thrown out, as I understand it. And again, I may have to sew my tongue up a bit here and correct and clarify. When he comes in on Sunday, he'll be able to give some more of the details from his perspective. And then you'll be able to hear the debate between Rotkin and Myberg the week after. How is this related to homeless civil rights issues? Well, not a hell of a lot, except that it has to do with public access to public spaces, which affects homeless people a lot, because public spaces are all that homeless people have because they haven't got their own private piece of the rock, so to speak, their own private houses, their own private homes. But it is also an issue about how the city council can twist an issue around and make it appear to be something that it's not. This appears to be kind of a neutral regulatory scheme for dealing with businesses and parks. It's actually an attempt to ratify police behavior after the fact when they issued bad tickets. At least that's what David Myberg sees as the issue, or at least when I presented that proposal, that formulation to him, that's what he said. He agreed with me that was what was happening. So we'll see. We'll be hearing more about that on Sunday, this Sunday at 10 with him, and then next Sunday we'll be hearing a debate between him and Councilmember Rotkin. And then Tuesday after that, you'll be able to go to City Council and watch the City Council, regardless of anything new that comes out, pass it unanimously, because that's the kind of method by which City Council proceeds. So there's kind of good news and bad news today. And I'm going to run through the bad news first and get it out of the way and then get into the good news. The bad news has to do with my lawsuit against the city, Norris versus City of Santa Cruz, which had to do with taking three former mayors to court, Mayors Kennedy, Crone, and Fitzmaurice, who on a number of occasions ran roughshod over my civil rights in city council, as well as those of other people, and generally had a sort of an authoritarian, arrogant approach, not simply that by them alone, but the attitude that the community has to essentially tolerate whatever the city council dishes out, unless, of course, they can get it together to do an initiative or gather such numbers as to make the city council think twice before directing people to sit down, shut up, or leave. Anyway, what happened twice, what happened with me, as I've mentioned on this show before, had to do with a mock Nazi salute, you're acting like a bunch of fascists salute, which has been winding its way through the courts for 5 years. The judge, Judge Ronald White over in San Jose, the federal judge who originally heard the case, throughout the case, saying, well, I was never charged with anything, but I tried then to charge the city with repression, to say that you cannot raise your arm in a silent Nazi salute at the city council as an expression of free speech, disagreement, strong disagreement certainly, but not anything that would stop a city council meeting, was initially thrown out by White. He said, no, that's bad behavior. You can't do that. Went up to the court above him, the Court of Appeals in the Ninth Circuit, and he was reversed by that court, 2-1 decision, and came back to his court, and he has again thrown it out. With a somewhat more elaborate explanation, stating that the council members aren't liable because they all have immunity because they were acting within the scope of their offices, and that my gesture was disruptive because it was part of a larger disruption. And this is going to be appealed to a higher court. It could take anywhere from 2 or 3 months to 2 or 3 years. So the case is again on the back burner. And my only words to people watching and listening to this situation is, don't be discouraged. Don't let this intimidate you or get you down. I don't think city council The public hasn't got much to do with city council anyway, even if they vastly liberalized their rules, even if they allowed meaningful questions to be asked of the staff, even if they didn't sanction people for making comments from the floor that weren't disruptive but that involved things like questions or the desire to make comments or even an occasional reaction or two, even if there was a broader situation. The very processes of this city council are such that, given the way it is, it's unlikely. For example, you have no citizen access to the city council except through initiative or through begging a council member to put something you want on the agenda. There is no way a citizen, as in some other cities, can put issues on the council agenda. So it's kind of a closed system to begin with. So don't feel that there's been some major defeat here. I mean, it is a defeat. I mean, I think council may be empowered when I make my next you're acting like a bunch of fascists salute at city council, which I've done since this started. Who knows? Maybe Ryan Coonerty will object this is indecorous behavior and demand I be removed from the room, and we may have another little scene, another little arrest. And there are really better places to go than city council. I haven't yet learned this. Maybe one of these days I will, to address people in the community and change opinion and get the kind of political power that's needed to change law and change practice in Santa Cruz. And, of course, we can change law and practice independently all of our own and are on Pacific Avenue. For example, groups like SAFE, Society for Artistic Freedom and Expression, the street performers against foolish enforcement, as I call them, who play every Wednesday night in front of New Leaf Market, continue to do so in spite of police harassment. And they continue to violate the abusive, discriminatory downtown ordinances, which are essentially a way of giving the police a near blank check to ticket, harass, move along people they don't like, and intimidate the rest, which is what has been happening, you know, in a way since time immemorial. But in Santa Cruz, it's counterbalanced by a community that I would say in significant part doesn't go for this kind of police repression, that really finds it abusive and something they don't want in the community. They recognize the police have a role to play in the community, but they don't like the idea that the police are running off poor people, hippies, or even people who are, you know, selling small amounts of marijuana. I mean, a lot of people in this community, 63% of them who voted for Measure K, believe marijuana should be the lowest enforcement priority, at least for those who are in private and who are over 21. And a lot of people feel it should be, you know, it's a much more beneficent and benign herb than stuff that you get in the bars or that you buy at 7-Eleven and smoke pack after pack of. So we're in the middle of a very crazy society, not to mention one that's engaging in routinized murder and imperial occupation every minute of every day overseas through its 737 military bases. So that's the context we're in, although you don't see all that in sunny Santa Cruz. You just see city council passing these kind of fluffy resolutions and then shutting down people there. Anyway, so the bad news was, to wind things back to where they started, Judge Ronald White has thrown out the lawsuit against the city council, which is now, as far as I know, going to be appealed again back to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals by attorneys Kate Wells and David Beauvais. If you want to get more information on this, you can go to indiebay.org. That's a website I recommend. For those of you who don't know it, it's www.indybay.org. And then /Santa Cruz, or just clicking on the Santa Cruz section, will get you where you want to go. And there's often information about upcoming events, like tonight, for instance, at 7 o'clock, there is a at the Vets building, there's an examination of the realities and legalities of U.S. policies in outsourcing torture. Public event featuring three expert speakers, a short film, question and answer period. Speakers Phil Butler, Don Zimmerman, and Bill Monig will be there. $3 to $5 donation, that's pretty cheap. No one turned away, so you haven't got any money, you can go. Again, that's at the Vets Hall, which is at the head, or is it the foot? Anyway, it's at the end of Pacific Avenue, near the post office, Lulu Carpenter's, and the town clock, in case you know those landmarks. That's at 7 o'clock. And you read about this on indiebay.org/Santa Cruz. Interestingly enough, at this particular event on torture, I'll bet you dollars to donuts you're not going to hear a word from Don Zimmerman, who is one of the speakers and an ACLU, I would even call him an ACLU activist, a local ACLU activist, which is kind of rare. Mike Rutkin is on the board of directors of the local ACLU. Sheila Coonerty, Neil Coonerty, the supervisor's sister, and Ryan Coonerty's aunt. He's the council member and vice mayor. And in part behind the supporter of the downtown ordinances that criminalize people. In every other city, the ACLU opposes these laws. Here in Santa Cruz, they don't do anything about them. But they did attempt to limit the parking garage paranoia law, as I call it, last year, which makes it illegal to be in a parking garage at all unless you have a vehicle or bicycle, and only for 15 minutes, even if you're parking your own car. So don't wait in the car and read a book. That's now illegal, thanks to the Santa Cruz City Council. Zimmerman, as I said, spoke out against this, and he has declined, however, to speak out against the larger concern, which is really a primary life-threatening concern, the sleeping ban in Santa Cruz. And it's always something I bring up on this show, even if only in passing, because it's so blatant, so abusive, so harsh, and so correctable. I mean, that's what's so strange. So the sleeping ban is for those three people who, actually, there are many people who have not heard of this, but the three people listening to this program who haven't heard of it. It's a law in Santa Cruz that was passed many years ago that makes it illegal to actually fall asleep on any public property whatsoever, and on much private property after the hour of 11 o'clock at night before 8:30 in the morning. And a sister law makes it illegal to cover up with a blanket during that period. So you're not only not allowed to fall asleep, you're not allowed to protect yourself against the elements. And if you set up a tent or something anywhere, even hidden away on some public property, even though there is no shelter for 95% of the homeless people in Santa Cruz, which is agreed generally by the shelter providers, we can't do it. We don't have shelter. They give out letters saying we don't have shelter to the court to try to get tickets dismissed, which sometimes works. We'll see if it works in an upcoming case of Craig Canada. This is one of the most egregious things, the sleeping ban, criminalization of sleep. Local ACLU has taken no position on it. It's a form of, in a way, torture. To make it illegal to sleep is to do what the Guantanamo does 24 hours a day, which is leave the lights on. You know, I mean, they're expecting you to stay awake. Although, oh, I forgot. You can sleep during the day. That's their out. That's, I think, what... Although Ryan Coonerty, the vice mayor, when confronted with this issue, said, you know, somehow it's our law is constitutional, and he couldn't quite explain to me why. Why bother? You know, he doesn't have to. He just continues on his merry way. He doesn't have to be arrested under the sleeping ban in Santa Cruz, and for that matter, neither do I. Anyway, Zimmerman will not be talking at this torture event about torture in Santa Cruz, or torture in Santa Cruz jails, or tasering in Santa Cruz jails, or the tasering death in Santa Cruz jails of a prisoner who was in a cell surrounded by deputies and yet still tasered to death. I think his name was it David Jones? Was that his name? I have to refer to indiebay.org. I wrote a story about it about a year and a half ago. So it's a real problem we have is there are these events about let's stop the U.S. government from doing all these bad things, but let's not worry about what's happening in Santa Cruz because, you know, that might involve us with problems. I mean, I have that same problem. I was at the coffee roasting company last night, actually standing outside chatting with some folks down on Pacific Avenue, and a woman who described herself, and I'm sure she was being honest, as the supervisor who was having a smoking break or a cell phone break or something out front, turned to a group of us. I think there was the people behind me were the people she was talking to, and said, you move away from the front of the cafe. You're not supposed to be there. And my companion, a member from the Poor People's Union of Olympia, of which more later, Jesse, we kind of looked at each other, and we wondered if she was talking to us because we were on the public sidewalk, and we weren't blocking anything. It looked like she was giving orders to people in a strange way. And then a few minutes later, she did the same thing again, and the people behind us sort of scuttled off into a move down the street. But we kind of looked at her, and we said, you know, this is a public sidewalk. You know, I think you're in error here. And she walked over and said, you have to keep a 3-foot distance between that railing and yourselves. That's the law. And I said, no, I've got the law actually right here. If you want to have a look at it, that's not the law at all. I said, okay, I'm calling the police. At which point I said, well, you could always, you know, you can call whoever you want. And she did. And within 5 minutes, there were 4 police officers there two rookies, or I don't know if they're rookies, but they were tall guys I'd never seen before. And then there was Sergeant Flippo, and then there was a woman in kind of plain clothes with a badge around her neck. Maybe she wasn't a police officer, maybe she was observing from another city. And they spent 10 or 15 minutes inside the coffee roasting company getting some kind of debriefing. And, of course, they did nothing to me. They didn't even talk to me. But it was quite an intimidating moment. And it presented me with a difficult choice because frankly, I'm a patron of the coffee roasting company in spite of some of the abusive activities that the management is engaged in Aptos. They have a coffee roasting company in Aptos as well as in Santa Cruz. And I just... you know, I meet people in there, I walk through there, and so forth, and I realize that for me to, even though I have the perfect right to be on the sidewalk and to talk to the people in the way I did and to suggest to the supervisor that, you know, essentially, I didn't say this to her, but and it was like saying, get fucked. You know, you haven't got any right to order us around on the sidewalk. You know, show some respect to the people outside. Don't be abusive to us. I mean, it's not appropriate. I have to risk, however, the next time I walk into the coffee roasting company, getting some kind of a ban, because I have to be afraid that I'm going to be retaliated against for essentially reminding her that though she may be the queen of the day in the coffee roasting company, she is simply another citizen on the street. And, of course, merchants aren't just other citizens on the street. They have special access to the police, particularly during this latest Santa Cruz crackdown, the crackdown that has resulted in a lot of fear, a lot of hostility, a lot of tension downtown, and some approval. I know I talked to some people, and some merchants think that the whole city was under-policed before, and that they deliberately almost let things go to seed, and so they could come back and do some cracking down. That could well be the case, too. In fact, that's what theory of some friends of mine from the 80s. That was what the police would do in order to force a progressive city council to act. They would just withdraw from the downtown and certain other activities involving drug dealing or other kinds of behavior that was, you know, antisocial behavior that the kind that's talked about. Large congregations of people blocking the sidewalks, sitting around, which actually has been pointed out to me, and you're going to hear in a speech later in this show, is it's a form of poverty culture. I mean, people who are poor don't have any place to go but public spaces, and so they use public spaces for that purpose, and that's perfectly legitimate use and a legitimate culture. And I think the folks from Olympia, Washington, who started the homeless encampment Camp Quixote, and they're going to talk a bit about that later in the show, at least this interview I have for you will talk about that, have a perfectly valid point. But it's always a question of balancing. They call it picking your battles and all that sort of thing. For those of us who want to assert our rights and also defend the rights of other people, and stop the gentrification of the downtown, where that doesn't just mean, oh, there are all these big chains coming in, but it also means local people, not just local businesses, but everybody is losing their right to use the public spaces without some stamp of approval from the merchants and the businesses nearby and the authorities in the area. I guess there's a story in the Good Times was mentioned to me today, which I haven't looked at yet, about a cop shop / host center going into the building that will be being built where the old Bookshop Santa Cruz was before the earthquake. And that, I guess it's the old Asian Rose area, that big area next to Lulu Carpenter's. And, you know, I wince when I hear about this because the police have been helpful to me on different occasions. You know, my car has been stolen 3 times. And on 2 of those occasions, Santa Cruz police have been quite helpful, really helpful, in getting my car back. That's my famous sticker car for all you folks out there who like stickers. And I've written letters of praise about the officers who helped with that, and I think, you know, I'm glad that that happened. The problem is, however, that not only are the police assigned to do these stupid, abusive jobs of arresting people for sleeping at night and destroying their camps and their tents and so forth. Actually, the police don't do this. They hire people to do this from Labor Ready, and the Public Works does this once Ranger Wallace runs through and cites these camps in the Poganip. But the police are essentially a kind of a strike force for merchants. They aren't, we're not on even territory, and we all know this. I'm not telling anybody anything new. And yet, there's a sort of fantasy that middle-class people have that they kind of grow up with. Because, in a way, middle-class people have the power to change this. If they wanted to, they could change it overnight, just like they could stop the war against Iraq and stop the war that is about to happen in Iran overnight. The power of people is immense if they use it. And that's why they have to be lulled and coaxed into not using it, into thinking everything's okay, into believing that let's let the experts handle it. Oh, you know, it must be some drunks, winos. It must be some drug problem. It doesn't happen to me. It's happening to those other people. They can't get their lives together, and so forth. In other words, the temptation to believe, well, for example, the city council is just this crazy Norris and a few other activists who are, you know, causing problems at city council. Why don't they just follow the rules and sit with their hands in their lap and, you know, talk at the right time and everything will be fine? And the fact of the matter is, people don't really realize this until the moment arrived that they need to have the freedom to speak, and then when they get repressed, they need to have the right to stand up and have people support them until their own house is going to be bulldozed through an eminent domain or a very, you know, a popular public area is going to be taken away. Scope Park is about to be removed and privatized. The Scribner Park, the park across from the town clock. Ed Porter, who makes these liberal gestures that essentially go nowhere, but occasionally have a sort of a heroic sadness to them, when he's not busy trying to arrest me for tape recording or shut down my tape recorder or whatever, or pat the police chief on the back, which he also does, metaphorically. You know, he has also done some good things at city council, sort of lone votes, you know. He tried to save the De Anza rent control. He tried at the last council meeting to determine, actually the one before the last, he didn't raise the issue, I did, but you know, once I raised it, I said, why are you eliminating a public park here without any kind of process here? You're sending it directly into a closed session of city council. And Ed said, I have to vote against this unless we get some assurance. At which point, you know, Rotkin and Matthews and everybody said, oh, no, we'll get all the information to you and the public before this happens. And, of course, not a word is said to the public. And it went to closed session last Tuesday. I don't know what the outcome is right now. who knows? Maybe it was announced at the very end of the city council session by city attorney John Barisoni, for those who had the patience to wait. But the fact of the matter is, the public process is really badly, not just frayed, because it, in a certain sense, it hasn't really existed. It has to be created by the community, and that's one of the jobs we have. I'm going to turn very shortly to I've been talking about the negative. Now let me talk a little about the positive. I went on for half an hour about the negative. There's some positive stuff coming up, and actually before we, maybe the positive is best dealt with by a bit of an interview with the People's Park Union of People's Park Union, the Poor People's Union of Olympia, Washington. These are three activists who were instrumental in helping put together Camp Quixote and also fighting the downtown ordinances in Olympia, Washington, a smaller community about half the size of Santa Cruz, up around Tacoma and Seattle in Washington, if you know those cities in the northwestern Washington state. And they have driven down here specifically to Santa Cruz because Free Radio Santa Cruz got in touch with them when they were being threatened by the police. No other radio station did, apparently, but we did. And they were impressed. So they thought, well, let's see what's happening in Santa Cruz and see if we can help and offer models, because they have a homeless run encampment going, Camp Quixote. They call it after Don Quixote by Michael Cervantes, the guy who tilted at windmills. And they came down here and let's hear what they had to say. I like their rap, and I hope that we can learn something from it.
Well, it's the 27th of March, 2007. I'm here behind one of the more exclusive cafes in Santa Cruz, sipping cafe with some activists from out of town from the Poor People's Union of Olympia, Washington, talking with
Jesse.
And I guess your two companions are
That would be Matt and Cassie.
And Jesse, we actually you came to town in a vehicular An old van?
I rode in the back of a truck with a dog. Very nice dog.
Name of the dog?
A Crowbar. And we also had a hitchhiker with us, which was provided company, and actually got some good sleep in the back of the truck. They had a cover over.
You drove all the way down from Olympia, Washington.
Olympia, Washington, yes. And Olympia, Washington is where the Poor People's Union has recently set up a homeless camp called Camp Coyote.
It was in February?
February 1st, we set it up in the middle of town. We were hoping to maybe get 24 hours, but the people of the town actually kind of rallied around us. Very big disconnect between them and the government of the town, of Olympia. And we managed to get 7 days, and then we became adopted by a Unitarian church, very fine people. And we've been working with them. We are looking for permanent locations and more locations for Camp Coyote. The PPU itself, Poor People's Union in Olympia, has been working for poor people's rights. We have now 130 members.
131.
131 members since Mr. Norris has joined us. Mr. Norris gave us the dollar bill last night, in which we cut in half. And he signed both halves, and the destruction of U.S. currency is the first thing you do when you become a member of the Poor People's Union.
Wow, criminals from the start. So the Poor People's Union was actually active in Olympia to fight proposed anti-homeless laws, or was it concerned about broader issues like rent control in the military and equal wages for equal work? How did that PPU form?
The Poor People's Union is a general Poor People's Union is concerned both with unhoused and housed poor, and it is concerned with the issues of the sidewalk ordinances that essentially criminalize poverty. It is also concerned with the issues of the exploitation of poverty by organizations such as Labor Ready and such as that. So we're looking to
Walmart.
Walmart also, yeah. All the people who exploit
Bookshop Santa Cruz.
I don't know Bookshop Santa Cruz. I'm learning about that.
Yeah. But I don't know the wage structure there. I know they were Neil Coonerty and the merchants downtown were instrumental in defeating Measure G, the local measure that would have raised the local minimum wage.
Right. Okay. Also, another aspect of this is we believe that there is not much difference between globalization and gentrification, that the effects of war from globalization and the effects of poverty from gentrification here are essentially the same thing. So we are also somewhat involved in the anti-war movement. People from the PPU were instrumental in confronting the movement of the striker brigades in Tacoma, and also the same people before the PPU started in the really denial of the use of the Port of Olympia for that purpose.
Explain what the striker brigades are, and I guess SDS, the Reconstituted Students for a Democratic Society, was also involved in that initial effort a year ago, and then more recently a month ago. Right?
There were SDS people among the main organizing people in Tacoma. And in fact, the people I'm down here with, I got arrested in that action, and somebody I might be down here with may have thrown a lot of tear gas canisters back at the police. I'm not going to confirm that, but so we are very much basically we are a group that is a coalition of anarchists, other radicals, homeless people in the street, and homeless anarchists like myself. I also come from a organization in Washington, D.C., MADE D.C., which is very much the same. Both of these organizations have been very, very successful. The formation of Camp Coyote in Olympia, the takeover of buildings in Washington, D.C., and turning them into shelters, have all been part of these activities. And we are attracted to Santa Cruz because of the the draconian and even, I would say, murderous intent of the ordinances here, which deny people the ability to even sleep. You can't live if you can't sleep. If you're going to have, if you're going to structure your society in such a way that you have this many people on the street, and believe me, Santa Cruz is not attracting them. Every town thinks they're attracting homeless people because of the great services. The services are lousy everywhere. There are homeless everywhere. Okay, but if you're going to have that, okay, you cannot deny, if you have that many people on the street, you cannot deny them the ability to stand, sit, sleep on the street, the ability to cook on the street, and even to build structures on public land, on which should be the commons. We have begun our organizing in Santa Cruz. We have members, starting with Mr. Norris, and we expect the same type of successes that have been achieved in Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, and Olympia, the capital of Washington. And we'll be here. You'll get to know us.
Wow. And that, of course, was Jesse from the Poor People's Union up in Olympia. Also traveling on this journey of organizing are Matt and Casey. Casey, what's this about? Are women left out at Camp Quixote? Is it a usual sexist, patriarchal setup?
Not that I've necessarily found, although I feel that, I think that it's very important, and we do keep it in mind that everybody has an equal voice in participating in the union and in the camp.
And have you been with the camp for the full 2 months it's been in existence?
I've been participating off and on, without much regularity, but I'm aware of what's going on there.
You live there, or are you a housed person?
I live in a house.
So why do you travel around with homeless people like Jesse? Don't you realize that this is going to ruin your rep? Oh dear. Well, Matt, you're also the plan here is to organize in city after city until the Poor People's Union overwhelms the capitalist system. And what's the plan here?
That's basically it.
You're kind of you spoke last night. We talked last night, late night, somewhat, about the issues of you mentioned the precursor organizations to the Poor People's Union. 100 years ago, there was the IWW, but they were actually organizing workers. You've got a bunch of shiftless bums, houseless ne'er-do-wells, junkies, drug addicts, or as one famous KSCO speaker used to put it, skunks, punks, and drunks.
Yeah.
So how is it you can even consider organizing these rejects who really need a lot of social programs and retraining and, you know, endless transitional stuff?
I understand your sarcasm. It should be worth pointing out that, Joe Hill was an IWW organizer, that the IWW began organizing in homeless camps and on trains, that the IWW has an extensive, long history. It's one thing that the labor movement has kind of missed is, organizing at the lowest echelons of, the class strata, to use some big words, that sector, that piece of the class equation usually gets left out. And so, even though we're not organizing in shops and we're not organizing, in storefronts, we do consider this, to be an element of the labor movement in that, these are people affected by the separation between rich and poor, and have their homes taken away from them and have no opportunity to get into housing. So, it's we do view this very similarly to labor organizing, although it's, it looks a little different because it's not as specialized. We're trying to get away from sort of the damage that trade unionism has done to the labor movement. But I appreciate your sarcasm and all that stuff. But people in the most disenfranchised places in our society tend to have the strongest communities. People in the homeless community, at least in Olympia, tend to know each other. Know who each other are, know where each other sleeps. And I don't think you can say that a lot of people that live in houses, they don't particularly know their neighbors. And if they know their neighbors, they certainly don't know their block. They don't know their neighborhood. And they certainly don't know everyone in the city. But people in people in positions where they have to rely, put in positions where they have to rely on each other to survive, tend to already have these connections made. And so, like, the organizing work is already really kind of done for everyone. Everybody already knows who each other is and where to get resources and sort of how to get by. And then the trick at that point is just, like, getting people to sit down in a room together and decide what it is that they want. And then the numbers are already there. The organization is already there. This, like, you know, it's not struggling to get people to agree that people need housing or need, you know, need places to sleep or need food or need protection for one another. Like, all that's already kind of, I mean, you can sort of have an assumed consensus about stuff like that. So, I mean, like, the organizing work is less about, like, getting people interested and getting people involved and more about getting people in the same room at the same time, which with some coffee and some sandwiches isn't always a big problem. So that's really that's what we're about in terms of organizing.
How did this happen in Olympia over the last year? I mean, I understand the city council proposed two draconian ordinances. Was that early on in the year, and was that the initial impetus for the formation of the Poor People's Union, or was it something else? It sounds like you guys and Gal came from originally the peace movement, or you weren't initially involved with homeless organizing, that, except possibly for you, Jesse. Who wants to take that question?
I don't think any of us were actually from the peace movement before, like, in terms of, like, the liberal peace movement. I mean, like, we obviously, the Poor People's Union, and then, you know, sort of reflects its membership in, you know, making the connection between neoliberalism and globalization, war, and poverty at home. And so it's sort of like the peace movement tends to only focus on one side of that. And so we work with a lot of peace groups in Olympia, and there's a strong support within the anti-war movement for the Poor People's Union in Olympia, especially with the OMJP, that's the Olympia Movement for Justice and Peace. The Tacoma and the Olympia Students for a Democratic Society, all, you know, we receive support from them. We do cross-organizing with them. But the OMJP did a sidewalk sit-in on the same day that Camp Quixote, our Direct Action Tent City, went up, and it was a coordinated effort in order to draw police away from where we were setting up tents by creating a bigger disturbance downtown and simultaneously sort of connecting these issues of war and poverty.
And I'm going to interrupt the interview with the People's Park Union from Olympia, Washington. We're going to hear more of that in a moment, because I got a call here from Julie Coleman. Hi, Julie. Are you there?
I am here.
And you're trying to locate Dead Man, right?
Yes.
Now, I'm not sure I even know who Dead Man is, but you know who he is, and it's his birthday today, right?
It was his birthday on the 26th, and it's just really been on my mind. I know he's down in Santa Cruz. I found a write-up on the internet for the Huff site that says that on January 18th he was interviewed by and it was a surprise speaker, Dead Man, Indigenous Preacher and Philosopher King. And they were talking about the supporting of the sleep out or camp out or something. But basically his sons have been calling me and asking about him, and my sister, everybody thought about him. He turned 50 on the 26th, and so happy birthday. His name is Kerrigan Dean Logan, and if anybody out there is listening and they know him, just let him know his family does love him. They are thinking of him, and he is a grandfather now.
Wow.
Okay.
boy or a girl?
A little boy named Ethan Aiden.
Huh.
So, and he was born last April. He'll be a year old this coming month.
So is there, if you want, you can, Julie, you can leave a message on the Huff line, 831-423-4833. And just maybe where how he can get back to you. I think you may have already done this with an email. If you want him to contact you, if I recognize him, you've described him as a cross between Jeff Bridges, Kurt Russell, and Crocodile Dundee.
Yeah, he's a very, and always has been, a very handsome man. He's about 5'6", very athletically built, nice hair, very intelligent, very political. And, you know, he's a good person.
Well, you know, for people looking to make contact, one thing you can do, of course, is you can check the meals on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday nights on Pacific Avenue, where some homeless folks show up and kind of share both food and song with the groups that kind of reclaim public space in the face of the downtown ordinances in Santa Cruz, which criminalize most any sedentary activity.
Yes, you know, I know. I happen to live in an up-and-coming urban environment in the Sacramento area, and where people are having hard times. And this morning there was somebody who was complaining about these three men because they were warming themselves. It was very, very cold, and they found a nice little spot on a little shopping market area that wasn't open yet. They weren't bothering anybody, and I just kind of, I don't know. It's hard. You know, life is hard.
Huh. So. Now, what's the city? What city are you from?
Well, we all grew up in Hollister, but none of us live there anymore. So.
Huh.
Oh, we're all scattered all over the place.
And the city you're now in is?
Sacramento.
Huh. Yeah, Sacramento could be a pretty mean place.
Well, it can be a lovely place, too. There are people who can live down by the river during the summer, and if it's a mild winter, too, there's a great homeless encampment all down there. There's bike trails that go in and out. And
yeah, but severely harassed by police. At least that's what shocks Sacramento Homelessness Organizing Committee has told
me. Yeah, it is. It is. They do not welcome or do anything to help. There's that Loaves and Fishes downtown and that, but no, they are not on the side of people who are having hard times.
So the message, Julie, for Dead Man, a.k.a. Kerrigan, is...
he's loved.
You're loved. Happy birthday.
Happy
We're sending
birthday.
You $5,000. Maybe not the last.
If I had it, I would give it. I'll tell you that.
All right.
And if anybody out there has it, I'm open for contributions.
Oh, all right. Well, send your... Send
We're all holding our head just above water in this family. And you know, bless their hearts for those who can't, so...
Hmm. So you would you say you're not on the edge of homelessness yourself, right?
I have been homeless when I was younger. I am currently 45 past due days on my home mortgage. You know, so yeah, it's, you know, life is tough, scrimping and scraping. Everybody is, you know, I think that's one thing that is really misunderstood. For everybody that looks at somebody who appears to have it together, they may not have it together as much as you think they do.
So you said you've actually come to Santa Cruz and looked to check out, and you haven't seen him around.
Haven't
when was the last time you were in town?
I guess it was just before it was probably around Thanksgiving time, looked for him. I can't drive much. I have seizure disorder, so I can't do that anymore. But his son has really been on me about, you know, if I could go down there, and I can't. So that's when I started on this. I was like, well, I'll just look. See what I can find online. And then the first time I put in Dead Man, this Huff thing popped up, and there was a conversation about him. So
well, I hope it's is it the same Dead Man you think?
I know it is.
It is the same one.
There was some conversation that took place that indicated, that mentioned Hollister. I know it's him.
Uh-huh.
So.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what. Again, if you want to leave your contact information with, and this is true for anybody else listening, if you want to get in touch with me, or with Huff, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, just give a call to 423-4833, which is the Huff line, and, you know, I'll pick it up, and I may forget it, but I'll eventually get to it.
All righty.
Julie,
well,
thank you.
God bless everybody.
All right.
All righty.
Same to you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And you're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. I'm Robert Norris, and this is still Bathrop's Pierre's Broadsides. We're listening to... the Poor People's Union of Olympia, Washington, which is currently, I think they're in Santa Cruz, but they're about to return to Olympia, and they're talking about coming back again. They put together a flyer they've been distributing, and maybe we can post it on the Huff website, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, at www.huffsantacruz.org. And, you know, you can see what they're up to, or you can always Google for Camp Quixote, or the Poor People's Union of Olympia, Washington, and you can find out what's happening there. And here's some more of what they were talking about. And we were listening to, again, Matt, Jesse, and it's either Cassie or Casey. I think it was, I said Casey on the tape, but I think it may have been Cassie. Anyway, back to that.
But I mean, like,
this is Matt.
Oh, I lost my train of thought. What was the question to begin with?
Cracky, I forgot it as well. But I think you've put out some interesting information there. So
What about these ordinances that were originally passed?
Oh, yeah,
and,
yeah.
Frankly, I think the overview is even more important than the ordinances. So what about these ordinances?
Well, the Poor People's Union actually began forming before the ordinances happened, but the ordinances are nothing new. In Olympia, in 2001, they basically attempted unsuccessfully the same thing, and the only way that they were unsuccessful was through sheer flooding of city council meetings, as well as a separate direct action tent city.
By flooding, you don't mean what happened in Santa Cruz, where some ne'er-do-well actually moved in and flooded a city council building with water. After it actually happened.
And then there was also an earlier burning.
And recently there's been an arson in the scattered arsons throughout the city. Actually, I have no idea who did it. And it probably wasn't a homeless person, or at least not a homeless person with a vehicle, because even with a vehicle, it was done simultaneously in five different places. So you say that you flooded the city council, meaning a lot of people came. And what was being proposed in 2001?
In 2001, it was a panhandling, car camping, and sidewalk sitting ban, really similar to what eventually went through last year in 2006. There was a direct action tent city. There's a really good movie about it, which circulates around Olympia. I don't know if you can get it down here. Maybe we'll send you a copy of it. It's called Homeless in Olympia, and it's basically about all the organizing work that went on around those ordinances.
Definitely want a copy of that movie.
Yeah, I mean, and 2000.
We'll show it down here and move benefit for the PPU.
Cool. Yeah, the 1996, they passed an ordinance. They passed a sidewalk and performance ordinance, which eventually got overturned based on its total lack of constitutionality.
But even more total lack of constitutionality. How come you guys get your stuff overturned and we just get our people overturned?
Because you have way more rich people here.
Point.
Rich people tend not to have any respect, not even for the laws that help them be rich. But, I mean, that's kind of a separate issue. But, in Olympia, the Poor People's Union actually began as a result of extreme weather conditions and a shelter crisis. People were really frustrated. Traditionally, during the winter times in Olympia, everybody gets really depressed. Santa Cruz, I've heard that there's been exposure deaths in Santa Cruz, and it doesn't surprise me at all, but I mean, in Washington, it's like not fucking around. It gets to like 11, 10 degrees at night. It's pouring rain all the time, so it's raining and freezing, and it snows, and it's really extreme. So generally in the winter, everybody is really upset. There's generally a number of exposure deaths, many of them that don't get discovered until springtime, when people find people's bodies in the woods. There was a massive, massive shelter crisis this year. There used to be this place called ESN, the Emergency Shelter Network, which offered a women and families transitional shelter that had emergency overflow. The Salvation Army, fucking Starvation Army motherfuckers, used to have, really clamped down. There's all sorts of allegations, which we will fully support and have documentation of in Olympia. I wish we would have brought it with us. But people at the Salvation Army exchanging drugs and money for beds, people in the higher up, particularly a man named Steve Ireland.
Take that, Steve.
Yeah. The Salvation Army has been sort of and they're massively city funded. So at the same time that the city passed the pedestrian interference ordinances this year, they earmarked $20,000 for the Salvation Army to sort of atone for passing the ordinance, which is just a bunch of bullshit.
So they paid off the people who were initially corrupt, and they passed these anti-homeless laws.
Yeah, pretty much. But ESN shut down. There was another shelter called Out of the Woods, which Camp Quixote is now sharing a parking lot with. Out of the Woods is a it's a three-bedroom emergency family shelter, which can't accept more people. There used to be a St. John's Men's Shelter, which was a seasonal overflow winter shelter run by a church congregation. The congregation voted to discontinue the shelter. Usually in the wintertime, overflow shelters happen in churches, and for some reason this year, the churches just weren't stepping up to the plate about it, and so there were fewer shelter beds this winter, and it was a more extreme winter than we've had in, I think, over 25 years. They passed the pedestrian interference ordinance at midnight on an 8-degree night, which is one of the coldest nights we've had on record.
Don't we want our pedestrians not interfered with? Well, it sounds like a very fine ordinance. At least has a nice ring to it. What exactly was this pedestrian interference ordinance?
Well, the pedestrian interference ordinance banned sitting on a sidewalk within 6 feet of a building. Do you mind if I smoke a cigarette? Banned sitting on a sidewalk within 6 feet of a building. which, if you're in Olympia, Washington, puts you immediately outside of the overhang and into the elements and into the rain. Also, you can't street perform without a permit. And then they made the permit fees really hard to get, and I think it's like cost like $160 for a year.
Is there a lot of street performing in Olympia?
During the summertime, yeah. I mean, like, when it's pleasant out, people, you know, a lot of people come out.
Got you beat on the sidewalk ordinance. Ours is 14 feet from a building. It used to be 6 feet, but it was increased to 14. Look for an increase in Olympia soon.
Yeah, I mean, we're expecting stuff like that to happen. Well, what really we were expecting is to overturn the ordinance, but
You have attorneys who will support you on this?
Yeah. We're right now...
Like Santa Cruz.
Yeah. We're getting help from... who is it? There's a man named Vince Brown, who's an attorney that's helping us with that. And then also the Seattle ACLU started...
Unlike the Santa Cruz ACLU.
I guess so, yeah. So that happened. The pedestrian interference ordinance also had a ban on car camping in downtown areas and, like increased ticketing for car camping, making like sleeping in a car illegal, which it already was. See, the thing about it is in Olympia, we already had aggressive panhandling laws. That's the other thing. You're not allowed to ask for money or hold a sign asking for money within 6 feet of a building either. So you have to either stand in the street or on the curb if you want to.
It's 14 feet, and you can't do it from a seated position or after dark.
Yeah.
Or in a group of three. Or at a bus stop. Or in a bus. Or from a car to a bus. And so I could go on.
Yeah, it's... I mean, we're pretty aware, and becoming even more so aware of the amount of repression in Santa Cruz, which is kind of why the PPU has shown an interest in it, both in its high population and sort of, you know, the Santa Cruz and Olympia have a lot in common. They're both college towns. They're both adjacent to major cities. They both come from, like, primarily white, you know, they're both suffering from primarily white middle class gentrification. Like, they've got, you know, the same motivations in terms of drawing tourist economies. Santa Cruz has the beach. We have the Puget Sound. It's like there are a number of similarities between Olympia and Santa Cruz that we feel like it's a, you know, we have a lot in common in terms of our organizing work. But the pedestrian interference ordinance in Olympia, is a redundant ordinance. There are already laws on the books basically criminalizing any form of aggressive panhandling. You know, they were using a rhetoric of, like, the story of the man being chased down the street by a crazy, you know, crazy drug-addled bum shouting at them. This isn't to underwrite the fact that there is, like, dramatically inadequate, like, mental health services, and people don't have homes. So crazy people end up on the street as a result of, like, a lack of these services. And I don't know if it's necessarily at that point the crazy person's fault that they're there. We certainly don't feel so. But the pedestrian interference ordinance was largely a redundant thing. There's a process. They're trying to turn Olympia into Santa Cruz, the city council is, particularly a city council person named Doug Ma, who takes money, runs as a Democrat, takes money from the Heritage Foundation, which, of course, did the policy planning for the war in Iraq, and is in bed with a number of developers in Seattle, currently destroying Seattle with condos. The pedestrian interference ordinance, we feel, was a divisive, redundant attempt to galvanize sort of the perceived middle-class Democrat voters who still have this classist fear of the poor into, like, feeling like there was a council member that was on their side, so that when he recently announced that he's going to run for mayor, so that when he runs for mayor, he's going to ensure himself a victory because, you know, he's done all this work for his voting base, which, of course, are the House middle class.
Did you have elections in 2006?
No. We have them later this year.
So this wasn't an electoral eve maneuver on 2006, but it's kind of a year in advance.
Yeah.
Electorally. Because I know that in Santa Cruz, the change in the downtown ordinance, at least on one occasion, 1994, occurred right before the elections. Well, four or five months before the elections and on the election year, although every other year is election year in Santa Cruz. So go ahead. I mean, I'm just... But I'd interrupt with that.
In Olympia, our downtown is very similar to Santa Cruz downtown. It's kind of like a one-street main arterial with, like, some side streets that have other stuff, except one of the primary differences is that in Olympia, certainly not to an extent that actually supports everybody, but the downtown businesses actually provide, like, jobs for people that live in town and not simply college students. It seems like when you walk around Santa Cruz, primarily the people working in the stores are, like, young college students, and while that's definitely the case in Olympia as well, also being a college town, like, the jobs around there, like, actually, like, supply the local economy.
And rents, I assume, are considerably lower than Santa Cruz.
Yeah, substantially lower. And so, like by a huge margin. Like, people are saying that you pay $600 for a one room in a house in Santa Cruz, whereas you could pay, like, $200 for that in Olympia. You know, simply a decrease in rent costs doesn't do anything to provide housing for people. You know, especially when you
and rent control simply makes it more difficult to build housing, according to our local anti-rent control people.
Yeah, that's a bunch of rich people. But just simply having a decrease in housing doesn't provide housing for felons. Doesn't provide housing for people with evictions on their record. Doesn't provide housing for people fleeing situations of domestic violence. Doesn't provide housing for people trying to recover from addiction who need more support simply than a low rent. And so,
speaking of that, what about the drug war? Is there any? I'll ask you two aspects. First of all, what about the drug war in Olympia in terms of increased police harassment and how its impact on the homeless community? And how do homeless self-run communities like Camp Quixote deal with drug use, alcohol? I should say abuse, not use.
Yeah. Jesse would probably be better to answer that question.
Okay. Camp Quixote, we have four rules: no drugs, no alcohol, no violence, no theft. And essentially what that means
is... What about medical marijuana?
I wish we could allow it. I wish we could. Right now it's a question of survival. That's a compromise on principles, and I'll admit that.
Based on what the demands of the church on whose property you're set up?
Yeah, but we also... It's not so much that, as we also felt that we had to not allow that simply because we wouldn't be able to survive with it. Okay, it would draw police, and we needed to wait with that.
Well, in Santa Cruz, if you let people sleep at night, it would draw police too. But I guess you're willing to accept that part of the possibility of police being drawn in Olympia. I guess in Olympia, you don't have a sleeping ban, right?
We don't have a sleeping ban per se, but. It doesn't make it easy to find a place to sleep.
Aha, wait a minute. Mike Rotkin, our city council member and former mayor, assures us that every city in the United States has a sleeping ban or a police practice of arresting people who sleep in public places. Perhaps you have the police practice of arresting people.
Well, all over the country there's a police practice of brutality against the homeless. I mean, that's a given. It's a given that you're going to be kicked unless you find a good place to hide. So that's part of what we do fight. But getting back to the alcohol and drug thing, we don't ask people not to be drug addicts or not to get drunk. All we say is you go outside the camp, you do what you feel you got to do, and you come in, and as long as you're not acting belligerent and driving everybody out of their minds, at some point you go to sleep, that's cool. I mean, we're not trying to govern some kind of morality for people.
What about Jesus? How does he enter into this?
Jesus, I think Jesus was pretty cool back in the day. I'm not too sure about the Jesus that's presented us by the churches. There's a lot of homeless or extremely Christian. That's what happens to you when you have to listen to a sermon for an hour before you're allowed to eat, then listen to all Jesus all the time as you're eating, and when the government, which is supposed to honor a establishment clause, counts the people who do that as part of the local services. Okay? So, yeah, there's a lot of Jesus thrust down the throat of unwary homeless people. Now, again, not that I have anything against Jesus. I think he was probably one of the coolest people in history. But
Maybe he was some kind of religious nut. It's hard for me to figure out, but a lot of people have used him as inspiration to engage in very positive activity.
Yeah, I think he was an anarchist, actually. Yeah. But
rendered to Caesar's what is Caesar, or was that one of Jesus's revisionists? I don't know.
Well, I think you have to go back to, we're going to go a little.
Let's leave that one by the way. I apologize. I brought it up. So you were talking about the rules of Camp Quixote. How big is it?
Camp Quixote right now is between 25 and 30 people.
And you mentioned earlier, tell me more about the rules, but then tell me the difference between Camp Quixote and, let's say, Dignity Village in Portland, which has perhaps been a model for Camp Quixote in some respects. This is a homeless-run encampment formed in 2001 by, I believe it came out of Street Roots, the newspaper and the Wicks decision that involved city's ordinance against camping in a vehicle. Actually, I think it was camping generally being overturned by a local judge. But Dignity Village is kind of an elitist is in the sense that only a few people can get in, and I guess there's a similar limitation for Camp Quixote, right?
We have kind of been forced into that limitation by situations, but still we try not. At first, anybody could just come camp there, okay? We do some vetting that basically is the exclusive basis for our vetting now is, are you really interested in getting this community going? If you are, we want you. If you're not interested in that, you know, we only have 25 or 30 people. We're kind of under siege, and we need people who are willing to fight for the freedom. Okay? So that's really the kind of vetting we're doing. Eventually, we want to be able to have space for everybody, no matter what their habits are, no matter how they act. Like you mentioned, a wet camp or something like
Describe
that.
Describe what a wet camp is.
A wet camp will be a place where you're allowed to drink.
Such as having the rainbow gatherings every year?
Yeah, like an A camp, if people are familiar with the rainbow gatherings. There's an A camp, and that's always kept to the side. But, you know, we're looking to be as inclusive as we can get. And our plans are to become more inclusive, not less inclusive. Right now we have certain boundaries we have to follow just for survival. We're like, you know, it's kind of like we're refugees from our original camp in downtown Olympia, okay? And at some point we want to reclaim our right to what should be known as the commons. Okay, that's where the name commoner came from, people who lived on the commons, people who lived on public land. Okay, we're commoners. The commons have been stolen from us. Okay, we intend to take them back. And right now we have...
You and Peter Linebaugh both.
Whoever that is.
He's a great writer who writes a lot about the commons. I'll show you his book sometime.
Okay, well, that's what we're looking to do, though. We're looking to reclaim the commons for the people.
Now, you traveled down here from Olympia. Did you come straight down, or did you stop at Dignity Village in Portland? Or?
No, we came straight down.
Santa Cruz was your target.
Santa Cruz is absolutely our target. I mean, the laws that have been going on the books here are so repressive, so death-dealing, that it was impossible for us to ignore.
Well, wait, this is activist propaganda you're listening to. Have you talked to Mayor Riley, or Smiley Riley, as we like to call her? She will reassure you that Santa Cruz is one of the most compassionate cities in California.
There is no doubt in my mind that I will meet your mayor at some point.
Possibly tonight at the Santa Cruz City Council meeting.
That is a possibility, yes.
It's been a... any comments? I haven't asked you any questions. What questions should I ask you, Cassie, that these two don't have expertise in? Or do you have any corrections, amendments to make, additions, or your own thoughts?
Everything that Jesse and Matt have said so far, I'm in complete agreement with.
Well, do you ever disagree with these guys? I mean, come on.
Well, everybody disagrees with everybody at some point.
Good point. How many?
Do you have anything to say?
Thomas Levitt speaks.
Do you have anything to say from like the perspective of the women involved with all this that, you know, that might not have come up because, you know, the other two people are males and, you know,
penis power.
Just anything from that perspective you have to say?
I feel that the organizing going on in Olympia, I don't know, it's it's kind of a constant thing with any kind of organization and any kind of thing that takes place in a patriarchal society, that there's symptoms of patriarchy that exists everywhere and through every kind of action that takes place. But I do feel that in Olympia, and specifically within the Poor People's Union and within Camp Quixote, there is a definite space available to everybody on an equal plane. And if anybody who didn't have a penis decided to say something, that would be heard with just as much appreciation and just as much understanding. Everything we do is based on consensus, and that process of consensus doesn't make those discriminations.
Have you been more involved with the Poor People's Union since you live in a house, and I assume you don't spend most of your time at Camp Quixote? I might be wrong about that. Is that correct? I mean, you don't sleep there?
No, I don't.
Whereas you do.
I did spend one night away from Camp Quixote in the past two months. It was wonderful accommodations at the jail in Tacoma. And
the Tacoma jail, yeah, I've never been there.
It's actually much nicer than the Salvation Army. The difference is the Salvation Army, they kick you out every morning, and the county jail, you can't leave.
They insist on taking care of you through the whole procedure.
They insist.
Unlike the Santa Cruz County Jail, where they kick you out in the middle of the night without any, often sometimes without your property and without any food, that's for sure. But Cassie, is it?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What about how many women are there in the camp?
I'm actually not sure about that. Jesse would probably know better than I would.
There's about 8 women in the camp. 2 of those women are part of couples. So that's 8 out of, right now, I'd say we have 26 people.
Any children?
No children. Mainly, this is another concession we're making to the perception of the homeless.
Danger of CPS?
Well, the thing is, people think homeless are going to attack children for some reason. They think there's a great...
Don't they eat children? Isn't that the normal thing?
Only on special occasions. But
watch out on those holidays. And of course, then there's the ritual sacrifice of children. They do that along with the local Hebrews.
I guess.
So what about organizing in the PPU? Are most of the bigwigs these, you know, macho male types who run around dominating all the meetings like we've been doing here?
I definitely wouldn't say so. As it, you know, just as things turns out, it seems that the majority of people that are organizing the PPU and that stay at the tent are male. But I don't necessarily see that as a reflection of the intent of the group. And I don't see that as a reflection of, like, ignoring, I don't know, the patriarchy that does exist in this society. And I think that, like, attention is paid to it, and there has been talk eventually of, like, as things stand, there's also been a lot of attention paid to the idea of making sure that everybody feels safe, and there has been attention paid to the idea of having a special section of the camp place just for women if they feel it necessary. And I don't think any of those conversations surrounding safety or surrounding like safe spaces have come up.
What's the deal with safety for women generally in Olympia, vis-a-vis the house community, vis-a-vis the homeless community, and what have your personal experiences been? A number of women I know are afraid to walk around in Santa Cruz. Some aren't, many aren't, but some are. And how safe do you feel walking alone on the streets at night?
I've never had a problem, and in fact, I do street outreach with an organization in Olympia known as Iggy Hop, the Emma Goldman Youth and Homeless Outreach Project, where we go out every night on bike carts handing out emergency supplies to folks that need them or folks that aren't housed. And
Needle exchange?
Yes, including needle exchange. And I've never at one point...
Do you have any heroin injection centers like they do in Zurich?
Not that I'm aware of.
No, we don't.
No, nowhere in the United States, I imagine. I keep hoping, you know, I dream on.
Yeah, but I've never felt unsafe in Olympia, especially from the poor community. The most of the time, or at any point that I felt unsafe walking through downtown, it's been at Barclays when drunk assholes with houses and that go to college are wandering around.
Naturally, your police would protect you from that situation, and you always feel quite safe around the police, right?
Oh, of course. I love the cops.
Are you speaking sarcastically?
Very much so.
Have you had bad experiences with the police in Olympia?
I have, maybe not to the extent that other people have. Like, I haven't been beat up by a cop, and I haven't had my tent slashed by a cop, and I haven't been thrown in jail for merely trying to survive. I don't know. My experiences, I guess, are a lot different from the folks that live downtown. But I'm very aware that those things happen.
Has there been an accommodation, this is a question for anybody, with the police in terms of Camp Quixote while it's on the Unitarian Church property? I know that there was concern the last time we talked about this issue on Free Radio and interviewed, I guess, you, Jesse, and two other guys, and possibly one woman, from Olympia, there was an actual immediate fear that the police were going to raid the camp and remove it within the hour when it was downtown, and then subsequently learned the next day you had moved out to the Unitarian Church. Are the police keeping hands off? Do they?
The story behind that one, too. Essentially, that night, the deal was made with the Unitarian Church. We all sort of relaxed because it's okay, the next day we're going to move. The local city government knows about it, and although they don't like the idea of us still having a camp, they know about it. We're going to be out of their way. 4:30 that morning, we were surrounded by police. They woke everybody. Pardon me?
Like
30 police, and Steve Hall, the city manager, who stood there gloating. They roused the people from their tents, told them you have 30 minutes to leave, and there's coffee and cookies across the street. The idea, of course, was if we were to leave within 30 minutes, we would leave all our camping equipment behind. We'd be over there be enjoying coffee and cookies and could go back on the street, and we would not be able to make the move to the Unitarian Church because we would have been completely disenfranchised.
How cynical of you. Now,
right.
Come. The city manager would not do such a thing. He would help to facilitate you, right?
I stood there in front of Steve Hall, and I told him that he had just ended his career. And I believe that that was an accurate statement. I believe that Steve Hall ended his career that night. In 20 minutes, they also gave us 10 minutes to leave, ran around yelling at us and stuff like that. And then the people from the church came and started helping us move very shortly. And
how many people went to get the cookies and the milk?
None.
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 A bunch of Spartan ascetics.
Nobody went to get cookies and milk. I will say one thing about one particular.
They try to help these homeless, and what do? They don't want any, they don't want help.
Yeah. Well, we forego the cookies and milk, but we did get Camp Quixote moved onto the Union, not in very good order. Because he had just a bundle of tents and throw them in trucks that were owned by the church members, and also by T.J. Johnson, who's a city council member who was kind of on our side, brought down his truck, reloaded pallets on
it. The same city council member who was arrested during the Stryker Brigade protest.
Yes, this will be the same city council member who was arrested at the Port of Tacoma accident.
Stopping military equipment from going to help the criminal occupation of Iraq?
Yes. So he's somebody who really understands the issues of the association of globalization, war, gentrification, and poverty. So, yeah.
One of seven, or?
He's the only one that I know of on the government that does that. So
let me interrupt this to say, for those who are listening who want to join the People's Park Union, People's Park is Berkeley, sorry. Poor People's Union, PP, all these PPs are like. What can they do? I guess you can call the Huff line at 423-HUFF. Or while you guys are in town, do you want to leave your phone number so people can call you up and the police can locate you and arrest you, perhaps?
Okay. You can. Matt can give them his phone number since he actually has a cell phone.
Yeah, a good contact number for the Poor People's Union is area code 360-790-7980.
Repeat that.
It's 360-790-7980. 80 Alpha Bravo Charlie. And if you want to, you can email Poor People's Union, one word, at yahoo.com. And they got a Yahoo Groups. Somebody's supposed to be building a web page pretty soon. Yeah, that's like good ways to do it.
Are you going to be in town? This broadcast should go out on Thursday evening, Thursday the 29th, I guess. Are you going to be around for a couple days after that, or how long do you expect to be in Santa Cruz?
I think we're only going to be here a few days, but that doesn't mean we can't come back.
And, of course, you can be reached by phone even as you travel through Tijuana organizing a chapter down there.
Yeah.
What's your next stop after Santa Cruz? Where do you intend to go to foment dissension and riot and spread, disruption amidst the local communities?
I don't know if we want to give that away too much, but there's a very evil city. Not evil city, but a city full of very evil cops. It's kind of like just north of Olympia, who weren't very nice. Although they had nice facilities, they weren't very nice to me in jail. And
Does it start with an S? No. A T, perhaps.
Maybe with a T, yeah.
Maybe with a T. Now, you're talking about, of course, Tacoma. But actually, I was wondering what your next city is going to be on your tour in California where you may be organizing.
I don't know. Personally, I have been doing this with Mayday D.C. in Washington, D.C. We did a lot of anti-gentrification work in New Orleans. I was there right after the hurricane. There's some very terrible stories about that.
Is it true that Food Not Bombs is the only organization feeding people, or is that just a Keith McHenry mythology?
Food Not Bombs was the first in the city itself. They were feeding on Desire Street. I got in a couple days after them, set up a pirate radio to tell everybody, among other things, that Food Not Bombs was feeding on Desire Street. After Food Not Bombs, the next people in were the Rainbow Hippies. And the Rainbow Hippies set up in Washington Square Park. They joined forces with Food Not Bombs. Food Not Bombs kind of got kicked out of Desire Street by I don't want to get nasty. Okay.
Get nasty.
By a Green Party member who didn't feel that you could leave a bunch of anarchists alone in a house.
Typical Tempest Morris, take note.
And then they went over to Mama D's, and I got rousted from where I was and went over to Mama D's. So Food Not Bombs was working out of Mama D's, who was a Rastafarian woman, and it was a whole Rastafarian crew that Food Not Bombs allied themselves with. And a bunch of anarchists went down there. And
what about FEMA? Surely they were distributing food, airlifting in packages.
FEMA was preventing any food or water from getting in. You kind of had to do a Jedi mind trick with the guards if you wanted to get food and water inside the city itself, which fortunately wasn't that difficult.
They were trying to protect the people inside from outsiders, right?
Yeah, and they use Blackwater Security to do that. I don't know if you're familiar with Blackwater Security.
Well, they're a group that's got great employment opportunities over in Iraq, right?
Yes, and also on what was called Baghdad on the Bayou in New Orleans. Blackwater Security guarded all the FEMA sites. And I took a picture of one of them one time, and he showed his crew colors by saying, "If it gets on the cover of Soldier of Fortune, I want a copy." So
at least he didn't smash your camera.
No, the guy before me, he did.
Really?
So,
somebody smashed your camera.
Not mine. Somebody else's. Mm-hmm. Then I guess they got some bad press about that. Mm-hmm. But there's been a lot of camera smashing went on while we were doing Cop Watch in New Orleans. One of our main cop watchers got arrested several times. In fact, I was after 6 months in New Orleans at Mardi Gras, I was basically sitting in a funny suit bailing out our cop watcher and somebody else who had objected to our cop watcher's arrest.
Matt, what would you like for people of Santa Cruz to do while you're here? Is there any people you want to hear from at your 360-790-7980 number? If people want to reach you, any groups you want to be in touch with, anything you want to tell the Santa Cruz community or anything you're looking for from the Santa Cruz community?
I don't know. The groups that we work with, the Poor People's Union that is works with or at least associates with in Olympia, the Movement for Justice and Peace, the Welfare Rights Organizing Coalition, ROC, Students for a Democratic Society, CLIP, the Committee for Low-Income Power, anybody involved in similar things to Santa Cruz, but primarily the Poor People's Union is about bottom-up organizing. Like, you know, it began, I've been a member of the Poor People's Union pretty much from the first day, but I was not, the guy that brought it all together and stuff like that. I mean, the Poor People's Union has been organized from its beginning and throughout its execution by people, like, living on the street. And so it's, like, if anybody happens to hear this that, like, could see themselves, like, participating in something like that, that's really who we want to be talking to, is, like, the people that, the people that are affected by these things that do live downtown and that have, like, a vested interest in things like this, you know. You can only really rely on, like, the liberal house community so far in terms of, like, how much their sympathy is going to, you know, be there with you until, and it is sympathy, until they see a hungry child on TV or something, and then they're off watching TV thinking about the hungry child. But
Or they see something that they feel threatens their own personal security or, principles. That's standard operating procedure.
So, again, for people trying to reach the Poor People's Union, 360-790-7980. Again, 360-790-7980, or poorpeoplesunion@yahoo.com. Or if you haven't got the money for a long-distance call, just try to spare change 50 cents for a call to HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. But, of course, then you won't have any place I could call you back, so it'll be a waste of money. But the number is 423-4833, and you can come to the HUF meeting where we supply free coffee and endless rhetoric every Wednesday morning. You got to check both the basement of the county building and the atrium between the county building and the courthouse, because we're not sure what we're doing. We're a little confused every so often, or just generally, actually. And that's every Wednesday morning between 9:30 in the morning and 11:30 in the morning. And you can also go to the HUF website, www.huffsantacruz.org, HUFFSantaCruz.org. If you'd like to terrorize the city council by inviting them to change before the Poor People's Union takes over, you can call them at 420-5020. For the purposes of Homeland Security, you should realize my use of the word terrorize is satirical.
We have a MySpace page, too. if you can do that. You just look up Poor People's Union on MySpace, and it's there.
There's also a MySpace page was set up by Barrett, who's the crusty guy that I traveled with when I first found Olympia. And it's called the Coyote Coyotes. And there's a bit of a radical flavor to it. Yeah.
MySpace is pretty funny, because, I mean, when people think about MySpace generally, they think about, just sprightly young high school students planning parties or something on MySpace. But MySpace is really popular amongst, like, a lot of people that live downtown in Olympia, because it allows them to keep in touch. I mean, like, friends of mine see their kids for the first time on MySpace and stuff like that, and get back in touch with their families. This isn't a MySpace advertisement. Fox News can go fuck itself. But I'm just saying that it's there. To clear up that misconception that, you know, people can't use computers or whatnot. But somebody else, I just want to mention this because it popped in my head just now, but somebody else yesterday tried to tell us that the reason why Santa Cruz had so many poor people in it was because they offered such fantastic services. And people were...
Is that a poor person who said this to you?
I don't think so. Maybe. I don't know. Probably not. But, like, I think it was a volunteer at a church. He was actually a really nice guy. And this is a really common misconception that, it's called the magnet theory, actually, that, like, if you build it, they will come. Like, if you provide services, it's going to draw everybody from all over the country.
Or
and so
if you allow human rights, everyone's going to rush there to get them.
Yeah, it's a strategy where,
you can't be the first to desegregate the bathrooms, because it would be bad, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And so, this is a, you know, if... What we found out yesterday, just by trying to find out, is there's no meal on Monday night if you're over 29. There's only one shelter with 160 beds. There's no overflow. You can't sit on the sidewalk. So, I mean, like, using the service, this is something that the Olympia City Council does as well, where they say, oh, we have such fantastic services, and that's why we have this problem. But you know, people sort of like discount the fact that like there are cultural centers for every culture, and that poverty has become a form of culture. Like, people are bound culturally to one another through necessity, and so it's like Santa Cruz is very similar to Olympia. When Jesse says before he found Santa Cruz, I'm imported from Southern California. People come from all over the place to these different places, and I think that that culture is just as valid and just as important, and is in fact like a positive as opposed to a detractor. When people say like, oh, it's these bums coming in from out of town, something like that, like people that are poor don't have a right to associate whenever and wherever they want with whoever they want and to, like, you know, have their own defined culture. I think part of what the Poor People's Union is about, in addition to like anti-class, anti-capitalist direct action, which is really our primary thing, what we're about, but it's also about like establishing a culture of mutual dependence and mutual aid, and like providing these cultural resources. Like, the Poor People's Union recently, like, is beginning to launch a campaign. Like, we do barbecues, ice cream socials. You know, we're going to start holding dances. Rock bands, like in Olympia, throw benefit shows where, you know, admission is free if you're a union member and you have your union card. You know, it's like, it's more, the Poor People's Union isn't all about, like, fighting City Hall all the time. Like, it's also about creating, like, a cultural style and a cultural event which is valid in the eyes of the rest of the world. And so I think I should add that.
Wow. Well, I wanted to ask a question. As people who like organizing poor people, have you noticed? I've noticed that in Santa Cruz, that like the people who like put out the most energy and put the most resources and are most concerned about these issues are poor people themselves. You know, poor people who might have a little bit of extra resources, who might be housed, but you know, are you know, they put out a lot more energy than your typical middle-class liberals. If you look at the list of most dedicated activists on these issues, most of them are, you know, poor and working people, and who give a much larger proportion of their own resources and time and energy than other people in more privileged situations. Have you observed that effect as well?
Yeah, I'd say so. But also, I mean, like, part of what the Poor People's Union is about is being anti-class and not class-exclusive. And so, like, the Poor People's Union doesn't exclude from membership anybody based on their class or position.
Allow the bourgeoisie to join?
Yeah, and bring pastries.
What about counts and monarchs?
Actually, the only people excluded from the Poor People's Union, as laid out by the Constitution, is law enforcement officers, elected officials, or anybody who can cause or has caused direct and immediate harm to another union member. Meaning that, like, if somebody has been assaulted by somebody else in a way that makes them feel unsafe being in a room with them, they're disincluded from the union based on, like, the immediate threat that they pose to the union.
Now, is the Poor People's Union's history and its rules on online? People can read them, or?
It will be very, very soon. We're not computer geniuses, so, like, you know, it's been a little slow on the uptake with the internet.
I don't want to hear any excuses.
Tough shit.
Indeed. We've been talking with Cassie, Matt, and Jesse here of the Poor People's Union of Olympia and Santa Cruz, California. If you want to join up, whip out a dollar bill and cut it in half with them, give them a call at 360-790-7980 or call Huff, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, at 423-HUFF, 423-4833. I could go on for another couple hours, but I won't. Any final words?
Well, thank you for being here. You're a wonderful contact to have made in Santa Cruz.
Take that.
Yeah, we're definitely really happy to be down here. And, you know, direct action gets the goods, you know.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to talk to us about this, and I just hope that everybody keeps in mind that these are going to be ongoing struggles for as long as we allow this society to exist.
Thanks to everybody.
And that was an interview 2 days ago with Matt, Cassie, and Jesse of the Poor People's Union, with Thomas Levitt and me sitting in and interrupting and so forth. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM. Or www.freakradio.org. And I'm now going to try to reach Attorney Kate Wells on the line. Looks like I may not have done that. Let me try again. I'll give it a second try. Kate Wells is an attorney who's... Ooh, I just got through to an answering machine. I'll have to give it a second try in a moment. She knows we're trying to reach her, so maybe, could be she's got some other call that is blocking this particular opportunity. But I'm hoping that we can actually reach her. And let's see what we got here. We got a ring, a couple of ringy dingies there. Kate is attorney with David Beauvais on the Norse case. Hey, Kate Wells.
Yeah.
Free radio calling.
Yeah.
So here you are, licking your wounds after a rather abrupt decision from federal judge Ronald White of the what's the district, the San Jose District Federal Court?
It's the Northern District Court of California.
Now, this isn't the first time White has misbehaved, right?
Probably won't be the last.
So what happened here? I've explained the issues kind of repeatedly on the air that we were trying to show the council itself was engaging in disruptive, repressive behavior, and we were simply trying to rectify that situation 5 years later, or I guess in one case 3 years later, because there were two incidents involved. What went down?
Well, what happened here is that this judge didn't like the case, didn't want the case, didn't want to try the case, didn't want to hear the case, and he let us know that once already, two years ago now, when he initially dismissed it, and he has taken, gone to great lengths, to stretch every imaginable legal theory you possibly could to get to the point where he said that we didn't have a case.
What he did was he granted what's called limited immunity to every defendant in the case, the three mayors and the police officer who arrested me.
Qualified immunity,
thank you.
Right.
And he also declared that the city could not be a defendant as well, or?
Right, the city liability is in just one sentence in the ruling, and it just says that that your constitutional rights were not violated. That's all he says.
And so what this means is that anybody holding up a sign, you're acting like a bunch of fascists. If they've been told that such signs are inappropriate in the past, because he seemed to think that was an important point, that I'd been warned that I could not make a silent mock, you're acting like a bunch of Nazis salute.
Mm-hmm.
I've been told that before. Therefore, having been told that, that was sufficient for me to not be allowed to do it, even though it doesn't disrupt the meeting. And one of the standards for any of the rules of city council is that you can't eject someone from the chambers unless you can show there's an actual disruption happening, right?
That's correct. He just bent over. I won't even say what he bent over, but
forward,
at any rate, he just... He just got it wrong, and not only that, we have several factual issues that should be determined by a jury, and he's totally cut us off from that. We have the whole motive thing in terms of them retaliating against you and for the content of your speech. That's gone without even a whimper. What happened procedurally is that these are the sorts of things that are usually determined in what's called a summary judgment motion. And what happens is they file a summary judgment motion, and then we are able to respond to that with our evidence, with declarations from people, and then the judge has to accept everything we say as true, all of the facts we say as true, and then rules whether or not they're entitled to summary judgment.
And the summary judgment motion means this even before the trial starts.
Right, right.
They are saying, you have no case, Robert Norris, you have to, even if everything you say is true, there's no case.
Right, but
and
then
in fact,
we have a chance to respond to that.
But he didn't
with
give
all
you.
Of our evidence.
It didn't seem that he, as I read his decision last night, I heard him kind of drawing some interpretations that I wouldn't have thought I would have drawn from the evidence, and I would have expected we would have presented alternate theories on.
Absolutely.
Claiming that I was, for example, one of the things that was said was that There were two instances. One was this mock Nazi salute to Mayor Krohn, which was silent and was, you know, it was a critical gesture, but it was not disruptive in the sense it stopped the meeting. It simply upset mm-hmm. one council member who decided he would stop the meeting mm-hmm. through the mayor, and the mayor let him do it. Rather, there was a second incident where Mayor Kennedy, made a decision that first I'd walked in front of the city council on one occasion when a parade, and then I'd whispered to somebody else, and then I had turned to him and asked him a question when he said, "This is your second warning, Mr. Norris," and I asked him what was my first, because I really didn't know what he was referring to. And the way the judge characterized this was that I demanded mm-hmm. of Mayor Kennedy what was my first. And it's not, right. And I don't think he I don't know how he could say that, because there was no recording of that particular statement.
He
sort of assumed that was facts agreed to by both sides, which it wasn't. You know,
which it was not. And
I mean, even if it were, it wouldn't be sufficient. But I mean, it's an example of, I think, rather clear bias on the part of the judge. You know.
Oh, absolutely. It's to the point where I think it's actually shocking. It is shocking to me that, I thought if anything he might grant their motion on the first incident, just because we really don't disagree on the facts on that one.
We presented actually tapes on both of us showing, I make a brief Nazi salute, and then and the meeting goes on, and then a councilmember Fitzmaurice interrupts things, says, "Oh, Mr. Norris made a Nazi salute, kick him out."
Right.
And Krohn stops the meeting to do that, disrupting mm-hmm. his own meeting. We're claiming that's retaliatory, mm-hmm. I don't disrupt the meeting, that they do.
Right.
You know, it's like they're saying, "Oh, you're not allowed to sit there, you're not allowed to do this, you're not allowed to do that." I mean, I guess you can warn someone about it. You can urge someone to do something. I mean, but you can't, unless there's a disruption created by what is done.
You have to instigate the disruption. Yeah. In other words, you have to. They can't instigate a disruption and then blame it on you. If our politicians can sit up there and say, "Well, that just offended me, and it just." You know, I just didn't like it, and therefore, I'm interrupted. I'm bothered. So I'm stopping the meeting here, and you've caused this disruption. I mean, what in the hell have we got if we don't have our right to petition the government for redress of grievance? I mean, my God, we have the right to be critical of our government.
A city council meeting is not a church service or a court proceeding.
It's the cornerstone of the First Amendment. Yes, you have the right at a city council meeting in front of the public and everyone to symbolically gesture that you're critical of them.
Well, let me put you another case, and I may be seeming to argue against myself, but I often do that. So, Tim Fitzmaurice, when he was mayor in 2001, established a rule which he later dropped, that the first two rows were going to be kept roped off for A, visitors, and B, media. Now, let's suppose he'd done this, and I had come and sat in one of those seats, and he had then stopped the meeting and demanded I leave that row or else be ejected from the meeting. What would have been my rights in that situation? According to your theory, I'm not being disruptive by sitting there, but I am violating a rule. So
I disagree with you there. I don't think it's exactly the same situation.
Hmm.
At all. I think if they had made a rule that you could not hold up a sign, you could not make a gesture, or you could not, you know, if that was an absolute rule that had been made, which, of course, I don't think they could do because it's in violation of the First Amendment. But, you know, if they made that rule, then they might have a case for that. But there's no rule like that. There's no rule like that.
Well, there was an ad hoc ruling by Fitzmaurice that the Nazi salutes were not to be permitted. And then I guess when Krohn became mayor, actually, this is an argument we didn't use. I don't think he raised the issue of whether, you know, he would accept Nazi salutes as being allowed or not. And each mayor tends to kind of set his own rulings, and they don't
The bottom line is that they can't make a content-based rule. the rule has to, any rule that they make has to be neutral as far as the content.
I think that's an important consideration, but I think in addition to that, it has to be clear to the public what the warning of the situation is. And though it may have been true that I've been warned 9 months before by another mayor, when a new mayor enters, I think a new situation may adhere because different mayors have different standards, and that evidence we hadn't had an opportunity to present.
Well, and as far as I'm concerned, the warning makes absolutely no
difference.
And
I agree with you that even had Mayor Crone decided he didn't want Nazi salutes.
The example would be, I'm warning you, Robert, don't you exercise your First Amendment rights, you know. I mean, if he'd warned you 100 times, what difference would that make?
Yeah, if he warned you,
it's without any kind of
right. A warning that violates a basic constitutional right is not obviously something that has to be obeyed, and it's in fact a repressive behavior by the council.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, the problem with the city council is that they have used a variety of tactics to kind of selectively and capriciously move on people with what to other people appear to be reasonable considerations. I mean, you know, there are a lot of people who look askance at a Nazi salute at a city council meeting. I mean, you and I don't, and maybe a lot of Santa Cruzans don't. Mm-hmm. But obviously Tim Fitzmaurice, and let's give Mayor Keith Sugar the benefit of the doubt. He's Jewish. I mean, I've got a Jewish mother, too, for that matter, which I don't
mm-hmm.
usually bring up. I don't think it's relevant.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if I wanted to play that kind of card, I could. It's... The real question to me is dealing with a city council that makes decisions that essentially repress activists. Because what we were going to talk about at the trial, as I remember, Kate, was the fact that I'm an activist around homeless civil rights issues. I present a lot of information around the sleeping ban, and I've urged the council to do something to restore the constitutional rights that its police nightly take away from homeless people. And, you know, that they shouldn't be, even according to the Ninth Circuit Court's ruling in the Jones decision and the decision today, which I'm about to read on the air, of the San Diego case where there's been a settlement requiring the police to not arrest homeless people between the hours of 6 in the evening and I guess, or it's 9 in the evening and 6 in the morning. So we were going to bring up the point that council had in the past established sort of they cut back my time, they'd moved agenda items around, they had interrupted me, they had thrown me out, they had threatened me from the back, they had particularly selected me, and we had witnesses who were going to testify to this fact, if I'm not mistaken.
And well, I'd also like to speak a little to the kind of underhanded tactics of the city attorney in this situation. Granted, they could not have gotten away with it without the collusion of the judge in this circumstance. I mean, what any really good judge would have done under the circumstances is say, okay, stop here, you know, let's have a summary judgment motion. All right, you know, plaintiff, you have the ability to, you know, file your evidence that you have and do it that way.
So instead of a summary judgment motion, what procedure did they use to short-circuit this?
They just didn't make a summary judgment motion. They waited until the last minute and then started claiming all this qualified immunity. And that's, you know, that's just that. By doing it that way, they deprived us of the opportunity.
Now, qualified immunity means that the council members who are being sued, the three mayors and the police officer, were actually acting within the scope of their duties and therefore couldn't be held.
No, that's not really it. No, it's a kind of a complex system that you have to go by, and what has to, you know, the law has to be clear at the time. A reasonable person in their shoes might have done the same thing. There's a whole bunch of stuff.
Sort of hurdles to pass. You have then if you prove those.
But
things.
Even though an individual defendant is immune through qualified immunity, the city is not. Immunity isn't available to the city, and all we needed to prove for that is that. That this was a decision by a policymaker of the city. Well, this is a decision of the mayor. You know, if he's not a policymaker for the city, who is?
The decision to have me arrested for walking back into the council meeting.
Yeah. So, that you know, and of course, like I said, the dismissal of the city was one sentence in this whole ruling.
There was no real explanation as to
no explanation. Done. You know. So, I mean, it's just, it's so vulnerable to attack. I'm, you know, absolutely certain that we're going to win in the Ninth Circuit. And you know, it's just a real pity that we've got to wait all this time, spend all this extra effort. I mean, we've been preparing for trial for weeks. You know,
this has cost the city over $100,000 so far, I would imagine, right?
Oh, I would imagine it has, yeah. And so but, of course, they're reveling in their victory at this point, you know. But again, we'll see who gets the last laugh, you know.
So what happens next? This gets appealed back to the higher court, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, or?
Yes, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. My guess is that this might even get published because it's a case without precedent in the Ninth Circuit.
And,
so,
and if they find it in our favor, do we then get sent back to Judge White again?
Well, we've already made the decision that if you know, I won't say when we win, that we're going to ask that it be sent to a different judge, because clearly this judge just doesn't grasp the concept, or he is so loath to find against the city in this circumstance, you know, that he's just too prejudiced.
Maybe he didn't like my T-shirt about George Bush international terrorists.
You know, who knows? And it's really hard. I'm dealing with him right now in another decision that he's made in the case of Quigley versus City of Watsonville.
That's the helmet case, right?
He dismissed it as well. You know, clearly an error. So, you know, he's just not what you would call a civil rights judge.
Well, let me ask you this, Kate. Is he, if this was the case, could we have asked to have him removed from the case on the first appeal? And what basis will we be asking on this second appeal?
But at this point, we would be asking for, you know, because of prejudice.
Because now prejudice has been clearly shown.
This would be for cause, yeah.
I see. Well, I don't know what, you know, maybe I should be speaking up on behalf of poor Judge White, but we'll see.
Don't feel too sorry for Judge White.
No, I won't.
Kate,
I ask you more.
He's
just up
there, you know, appointed for life. You know, he's
how much
he's
do
not,
these judges make
not anybody to pity.
And this is more money for the city attorney's office as they fight this case.
Oh, of course. Of course.
And you're, of course, getting paid big.
You're getting, appeal now.
You're getting paid big bucks to do this case, too, right?
Oh, yeah, right. A lunch here or there. And
yeah, I got you. I brought you lunch the other day.
That's right. Complaining that's what about. I just said. Yeah, hey, I get lunch.
And you get gas money every so often?
You know, I mean.
Occasionally,
yeah, right,
a candy
I'm
bar.
Making the big bucks on this one.
Hey, listen, Kate Wells, thank you very much.
All
and
right.
We'll talk to you again when we can grab you.
Cool.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And that was Attorney Kate Wells, the issue, my recent, the case that I had against the city being thrown out by Judge White, going back up to the Court of Appeals once those papers are filed. Very quickly now, because the next show will be coming in, I'm going to read the positive side of some, I mentioned at the beginning of the hour, boy, do I have it here. I hope I do. Let's see. Let's go back to here and take a look. Here we go. Victory over the sleeping ban. This is from San Diego. Sleeping in San Diego's public sidewalks and doorways at night will no longer earn you a ticket, the city announced on February 21st. As part of settling a lawsuit brought by homeless advocates, Mayor Jerry Sanders, who in the past had opposed creating homeless free zones, called the move a fair and equitable solution to a large societal problem. City Attorney Mike Aguirre said San Diego has taken the leadership in the state of California in how to receive or resolve these conflicts over homeless proper lodging. Starting immediately, people can sleep on city property from 9 p.m. to 6 a.m. without fear of police citations. That is, unless they are doing something else illegal, such as being drunk or a public nuisance. Sleeping on private property is not covered by the change. Tim Cohelan, lawyer for the homeless plaintiffs, said the real solution for homeless people is more shelter beds to get them off the street. And then in today's San Diego Union Tribune, this is an article. It's been more than a month since police and homeless advocates celebrated a settlement to a class action lawsuit that would make it legal to sleep on the streets of San Diego overnight. Margaret Armstrong, shown yesterday in Balboa Park, where she used to live, was ticketed, arrested, and jailed for sleeping in public in 2004. She was among the nine plaintiffs in a class action suit on illegal lodging in San Diego. But before the court-approved agreement could formally take effect, lawyers had to find the plaintiffs, or at least one of the nine men and women, to sign the official settlement papers. Well, they did. And that's it for this edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides. Come on back on Sunday. We'll talk more about this case and another victory in Las Vegas. And we'll be having with us attorney Ralph, I should say David Myberg, as a sort of a introduction to a debate a week later with Mike Rotkin on the law a city is about to pass, which has some impact on all of us. Thanks for being with me on this edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides. I will return, and I hope you will too.
escape. Just to drive to my baby. From San Francisco today.
And welcome to From the Cream to the Dregs, a weekly exploration of the music of the 60s and the 70s, and who could be more 60s than the Who? I'm Uncle Dennis, your host, tonight on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1. We'll be here till 11 o'clock with music, environmental news at 9, and of course our very special hour-long spotlight group of the week, so stay tuned for all of that. We got just all kinds of great stuff here on Free Radio. We've been on the air for 12 years without no stinking license, and we just enjoy the hell out of what we do. So sit back, enjoy. We'll have the brew of the week coming up in just a few minutes.
There's a girl next door to me, it's around the bend. But she wonders why she can't make any friends. Can you hear me? Here we go round the lemon tree.
junk was rocking, going round and round. Oh, baby, with a crazy sound. And it never stopped rocking till the moon went down. You know it sounds so sweet, I gotta take me a chance. Rose out of my seat, you know I had to dance. Started moving my feet, oh, clapping my hands. But they kept on rocking, going round and round. Oh, baby, what a crazy sound. And it never stopped rocking till the moon went down. Oh, you don't rock, going round and round. Come on, baby, what a crazy sound. And it never stopped rocking till the moon went down. When the police knocked, both doors flew back. Kept on rocking, going round and round. Oh, baby, had a crazy sound. And they never stopped rocking.
Hate me. There's no one like you, Eleanor.